My next guest is an expert in the two things that are near and dear to my heart, and that is the law and comedy. And while people generally don't see a connection, Carl Unegbu certainly does. He's considered the foremost authority on the intersection of comedy and the law, and has written a book using stories about famous comedians to make people aware of ways to avoid lawsuits and legal entanglements. He was a New York attorney. He is a reporter in New York, then a longtime editor of Comedy Beat website. And his new book, Comedy Goes to Court When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting, is out and receiving rave reviews. Carl, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
Good. Thank you, Carrie. I appreciate being on.
So let's talk about lawyers and comedians. First of all, do we see a parallel here between the two professions?
Not in any direct sense. Lawyers, they talk for a living, both of them, except that they talk for a living with different goals in mind. Lawyers talk to the judges or juries to convince them to persuade them to their point of view. Comedians also try to persuade people, but this time they do it to get a laugh. So one is a lot more serious in terms of like what the goals are. But broadly speaking, yeah, they both talk for a living, and the whole idea is to persuade people either to laugh or to come over to their point of view.
You know, a lot of my listeners know that my father was a stand-up comic for many, many decades, and he worked in the Playboy Clubs and the Catskill Resorts, and so I grew up in a family where he was a comedian. It was a really interesting way to grow up, now that I know that it was different than everyone else's upbringing. But I kind of do see some of the parallels now that I'm a lawyer, because I feel like in some ways, yes, I'm trying to convince the judge or the jury of something serious, but I also have to get them to know me and like me and trust me. And I think comedians have to do the same thing, even if they're offensive and they're playing someone who's not so likable, but you still kind of have to get to know them and trust them. So I just think that's interesting. And your book is an interesting premise for this whole thing. Let's talk about, can you protect a joke? You're a comedian. You want to tell a joke. You came up with this joke that's your own, and now you see some other comedian using that joke. Is there some way that you can protect it?
Well, obviously, I mean, technically you can, of course, but, it's as a practical matter, given the state of the law at this time, it's not that easy. I mean, I give you a quote from David Brenner. He says, it's easier to catch a serial killer than to stop a serial thief of a joke, a serial joke thief in comedy. Now, if we could protect our jokes, he'd be a billionaire somewhere in Europe today. And that's like the reality of what happens in comedy. There is protection, but it's sort of more theoretical than real, given the present state of the law. I think a more effective protection for jokes at this time, really, it's sort of like something the industry has to do for itself, some kind of industry self-regulation, which happens sort of more informally, but it does. I mean, if somebody is a booker at a comedy club or who books comedy events, they'll be hard put. They'll be disinclined to put on somebody who is known as a thief, a joke thief in the industry. And, if somebody steals their jokes, comedians know who the joke thieves are, and the word gets around. So you could get blackballed easily when it comes to that sort of thing. But with respect to what the law does, the protection of comedy jokes is sort of weak, which is unfortunate. But if you compare that to the protection for movies, and let's say music, those ones, the word that comes to mind is effective compared to what you have with respect to comedy. For instance, for comedy, there are two parts of a joke. A joke has two parts. There is the premise, and then there is the punchline. Well, the premise is sort of like, you might think of the premise as sort of like the vehicle that carries the joke to its finish line. And then the punchline is the thing, the zing you put at the, at the punchline, at the finish line. So, yeah, so those two parts. Well, in comedy, what tends to be protected at the present moment under the copyright regime that prevails at this time. What tends to get protected is just the punchline, you know, the words of the joke. As long as somebody doesn't repeat the same words, then that person can pretty much, you know, get away with maybe stealing the joke. But the way comedians understand jokes, they understand jokes more fully, in the sense that jokes are intricately bound up, you know, the punchline and the premise. Usually they are bound up together. You don't get to the punchline unless you've been carried to that place by the premise. You know, like I said, you know, you can think of it as like the vehicle that drives the joke to the finish line.
Well, I think the main thing that I see is that to copyright something, you can't copyright an idea, you know, and if you paraphrase something, that you're not stealing anything. Now, you're talking about being blackballed and shamed if you're a joke stealer, and I get that. I would imagine that is a bad thing in the profession. You don't want to be around people who are stealing other people's jokes. But, you know, as my dad used to say, there's no such thing as a new joke, just a new audience. And we've retooled jokes for years. You know, we've, you know, made fun of different kinds of people in different kinds of scenarios. And I hear things all the time that I heard my father tell, you know, 50 years ago. And it's just a new form of the old joke. I want to talk a little bit about how comedians are paid. And I'm not talking about the big people, the Seinfelds and the Dave Chappelles and Conans. I'm talking about the guys who are doing stand-up comedy in the different venues. How are they paid?
Well, now you're dealing with the area of contracts at this point. And again, you know, it's a free territory, it's a free society. People negotiate their own deals, and the idea is to go with whatever the market can bear. So sometimes, you know, you could get paid, you know, sometimes a flat fee. I mean, that's too loyally. It sounds too loyally, but, you know, you can get paid, you know, a flat fee, or you can get paid maybe a percentage of the, you know, money that comes in, you know, from, you know, people paying at the door or, you know, tickets and stuff. So, I mean, it kind of runs the gamut. But again, it also is a question of the market you're playing in. I mean, there are different comedy markets. I mean, if you're doing a show at the Marquee, New York, on a comedy club, say the Comedy Cellar or, you know, Caroline's, the, you know, Caroline's is no longer there, but, or maybe the, or Gotham. Yeah. It's not the same thing as doing a show in, say, they sit in Idaho somewhere, you know. I mean, I don't mean to knock Idaho, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's,
yes.
These markets are different in terms of, like, how people think of them and comedy. So, yeah. So, it depends on a whole bunch of factors. But, again, you know, whatever deal you decide to make, you want to be sure that the deal is properly struck so you can actually get paid, because, you know, there have been situations where people have had trouble getting paid. And there is no shortage of people who are willing to not pay you. I mean, it's not the industry, you know, it's a great industry, but then there are also folks who, you know, do things that are not so good. So you have to be sure.
Yeah, I think that's always been the case, and I do remember some unsavory characters who would, you know, try to short my father, and, you know, you have to count the money on the way out, and, you know, I hope things have improved. Let's switch to a topic that is really hot right now. You know, I was thinking, we just had a play in town about Lenny Bruce, and I unfortunately didn't get a chance to see it. But in the 60s, early 60s, Lenny Bruce was arrested for some off-color material. They call it the blue material. And and even just 10 years after that, George Carlin was arrested in Milwaukee at Summerfest for using obscenities during a performance. And as much as we kind of look back and say, oh, we're in a different place right now, I don't know. I think we see a lot of people being very sensitive to jokes that have to do with race and gender and all of these things. Are we going back to that day where we might start seeing that laws are created or enforced that are going to be punishing comedians who make these off-color jokes?
Two things. Now, first, the concern about Lenny Bruce, he was prosecuted for obscenity, and at the time he died of a drug overdose in 1966, I believe it was, he was still a convicted felon because the appeal he filed had not yet been decided. And it wasn't until, I think, 2003 that the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, pardoned him for a conviction that occurred back in the 60s. But as of today, I think he was... the last the thing with George Carlin happened, but those were the, I think people kind of drew a line under those things after it happened to those gentlemen. Today, there are no comedians who run the risk of getting arrested for, you know, saying those kinds of things today. Of course, there is the law of obscenity. If something you say is obscene, it's perceived as obscene, then, you know, there is no First Amendment protection for that. But the other thing I want to say is this. In other countries, which is so embarrassing, but that's true, even in Canada, in places where you don't have the First Amendment, in Canada, you could get in trouble for saying some things that the government believes you should not be able to say. Like, I have a case in the book about a comedian called Mike Ward who attacked a disabled kid named Jeremy Gabriel. You know, this kid had a disfigured face because he had what they call, I think, Treacher Collins syndrome, you know, disfigured his face and his skull. So he looks kind of funny like that. And then this comedian attacked him for being ugly and things. And then the kid's family reported, you know, made a complaint with the Human Rights Commission. And then they ended up imposing a heavy fine on this comedian for attacking the dignity, quote unquote, of the kid. I mean, an American would not imagine that a thing like that could happen here. You attack somebody's dignity and you get in trouble, you get fined. It doesn't happen here. Or, you know, in Germany, for instance, there was a comedian, another case I have in the book, Jan Böhmermann, who attacked the leader of Turkey, the country of Turkey. I mean, he said, you know, he was making a satirical commentary, and he was saying that this leader of Turkey, that he had sex with goats and watched child porn, you know, that kind of thing. Well, you know, the Turkish government complains to the German government that this guy needed to be punished for saying something that was completely beyond the pale and things like that. And for a while there, the German government actually investigated this guy for possible prosecution. You know, they ended up contorting their way out of having to prosecute him and everything. But the Turkish government was satisfied that at least, you know, the German government was taking this seriously. It so happens that in Germany, there's actually a law against defaming a foreign leader. You could actually go to jail if you insult a foreign leader. And then, you know, in Scotland today, if you live in Britain, in Scotland this month, a new law came into effect called the hate crime law. In other words, you could go to prison for about 7 years and incur heavy fines if you are accused and maybe convicted of engaging in stirring up hate against a group defined by race, you know, disability, national origin, religion, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, these are things that an American could never imagine happening.
Yeah,
here.
I mean, those are good examples, and unless you really travel and you see how that works, you don't appreciate it. I was just on a trip to Vietnam, and I asked a question that apparently was sensitive, and the tour guide came and said, you know, I'm free to talk, but after I talk, I may not be free. And it was that serious where that person felt like that, you know, that she could disappear, and so could the family, and that it would happen. So, you take away these things, and thank God for the First Amendment, because it really does protect us.
You know, I have a guy who came to one of my book readings, and he's a Chinese comedian. And he told me how things happen in China, how, like, to make a comedy joke, you have to have it approved by the authorities. So if you go on stage and you make a joke that was not approved, yeah, you know, you have stepped over the lines and you're going to get it. You know, so, I mean, it's so bad in a lot of places, really. But this country, thanks, you know, for the First Amendment, which is a wonderful legacy, you know, we remain free to make jokes and, you know, there is a wide room to swing one's arms. But the only problem we have here is the cancel culture and the woke ideology that, you know, could actually deny you a chance to make a living, despite what you're saying, being protected by the First Amendment, if you get what I mean.
I really appreciate you coming on, Carl Unegbu, who is the author of When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting. Thank you so much for joining us. You take care of yourself.
Thank you, Karen.